So knowing when it's something is good enough to move on, it sometimes it takes that external kick in the pants to get going.
Welcome to the Baker Lab Podcast. I'm Ian Hayden with the University of Washington.
I'm David Baker at the University of Washington. I'm really excited that with this podcast, we're able to get the stories of the amazing scientists who've come through here, at least some of them. And my real hope is that people anywhere, young students anywhere, will be able to listen to this and become inspired that they too could become a scientist and go on to start companies or do other things. And to that end, if you like this production, please share it with friends, particularly younger people who may be thinking about what to do for their next stage of their careers.
I've really been looking forward to this episode. Today, we'll be hearing from Ingrid Swanson-Poltz. Her student-led project to create a new treatment for celiac disease took first place at a major international science competition and grew into a successful biotech company. Ingrid is a true pioneer and someone I deeply admire. Her story is about building things and the surprising places that that can take you. Let's get into it.
My name is Ingrid Swanson-Poltz, and at the IPD, I am a translational advisor.
All right. We're going to get into what that means in the second half of this episode. But I want to begin this conversation at the beginning. Tell me about what you were like as a kid or as a student early in life.
So I grew up in Minnesota. I've always been interested in building. My favorite toys were Legos. I loved any type of building toy, any type of art. I had two brothers, and they always got the best toys. They got the Legos from people that didn't know me very well. I always got, you know, dolls and dress up, and it just was not into it. So I would swap. So I would build my brother's Lego sets, and in return, I would give them my, you know, Barbies to play with. And they were into action figures, so they would play whatever, you know, Skeletor dismembers unsuspecting victim. Mm-hmm. But this is not to say that, you know, that people who enjoy playing with dolls can't be scientists. It's just saying that I had this interest that pretty much people just kind of assumed that I didn't have when I was a kid. But I loved biology, so I went to Boston for college. I went to Wellesley College and studied biology as my major and minored in music. And I was really into molecular biology and biochemistry, really into the way that the different parts fit together to make a living system. So because of that interest, I went to the Jackson Labs in Bar Harbor, Maine, which makes a lot of transgenic and knockout mice, and studied virology there. My intention was to study biology in a very simple system. But with virology, viruses are dependent on the host organism, so things can get pretty complicated quite quickly. So even though I learned a lot about molecular systems at the Jackson Labs under the tutelage of Tanya Golovkina, I wanted to go into the smallest unit of life that could be considered life. So I was really interested in bacteriology. And I came to the University of Washington for graduate school because the UW has, you know, such a strong microbiology and biochemistry program. I studied with Sam Miller in the Department of Microbiology. During graduate school, I got a really great background in molecular biology and molecular machines. I had a little engineering project to engineer sensors to do the basic research part. But I really enjoyed that biological engineering aspect of my project, and I wanted to make that kind of the full goal of a project. And so my graduate work was focused on this, you know, how do I bring engineering into this? I was also in a band in graduate school. I played drums in a band with another graduate student. We called ourselves the Wild Types, and our big crowning moment was when we played at Chop Suey in Capitol Hill.
Wow.
So in graduate school, I wanted to kind of bring that engineering into it as a primary goal. So I'd heard of the iGEM competition at MIT. There was an article in Nature that described this competition. And this is it stands for the International Genetically Engineered Machine Competition. And it is a competition in which undergraduates, advised by graduate students, postdoc, and faculty, design, build, and test a new biological molecule or biological system over the course of the summer. And then they travel to MIT in the fall and they present their work and they compete against other teams from all over the world. You know, there's lots of different potential applications that can be targeted, and that's pretty much limited by your own imagination. The unifying theme is to use the tools of synthetic biology to generate something new using biology that's never existed before that has the potential to help humankind in some way.
So could you place this in time? When did it first get on your radar?
2007. So that was when Nature published that article.
Yeah.
And that was in around, I want to say, January-ish of 2007.
Describe what iGEM was like at that time.
It was a lot smaller. I think it began in 2004, 2005.
Okay. So it's still early years.
But it was tremendously exciting because this was the synthetic biology movement, and it was a little more about DNA than proteins, like stitching together different promoters to different genes and getting expression. You know, there's an iGEM project of producing bacteria that smelled like bananas in exponential phase, and then when they hit stationary phase, they smelled like mint. So the idea is that you could smell your culture. The world-changing application of that is questionable, but it's a elegant way of demonstrating that we now have the power as human beings to change life at a small scale, make these little living machines to do what it is that we program to do.
So iGEM, one of the terms of arts that I think is used even today in iGEM is parts. They talk about parts and parts databases and libraries. And so in iGEM speak, what's a part?
A part could be a promoter, a gene, a part of a gene, things that you can, like Legos, put together and make new, you disassemble them, you can find them in nature, you can build them from scratch, and you can put them together in new combinations to make something that's never existed before.
Gotcha. So it's all these little bits of biology broken out. I think the Lego analogy is pretty good here. It's these little more or less standardized building blocks. And then the idea for the competition is these teams of students with their mentors reconfigure from a big bucket of parts, their favorite ones or the most interesting ones, to do something.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's right. One of the main parts about iGEM is that it is a competition and students love to compete. So the iGEM projects have been pretty remarkable. And some of them just completely crash and burn, and others just really flower into cool things.
Can we go through your experience with iGEM? How did you get involved in that?
Yeah. So when I read that article, I was like, this is exactly what I want to do. So I figured that I would, join the UW's iGEM team as an advisor. But the UW didn't have a team because that was still pretty early iGEM days. So I went to iGEM in 2007 that year and learned what it takes to build an iGEM team. And then I came back to the UW and I founded the UW's iGEM team. And at that time, that was 2008, and the UW was pretty flush with cash, so it was a different time. I got funding from microbiology, biochemistry, bioE, electrical engineering and computer science to run the iGEM team. And I also convinced the Department of Microbiology to let me use their teaching labs over the summer so that we had lab space and some basic lab equipment. And so one of iGEM's premises is that the students should be the ones that come up with and direct the projects. And I really took that to heart. So we had a crazy idea that year, which was like bacteria talking to yeast and like developing a cross communication language. It was a crazy project, but we did manage to get a couple of basic things working and generated some new parts, and students learned a lot that year. I love working with students, but I didn't get a whole lot done in my PhD program. So we got runner-up, a best presentation that year. But unfortunately, I was ready to say, this has been a great experience and a lot of fun, and I am done because I can't do it anymore because of all the work that goes into it. But I was incredibly lucky in that one of my iGEM students that year, Jeff Navala, who is now a professor in computer science and electrical engineering, actually, was an undergrad that worked in David's lab. He was doing an undergraduate research project in David's lab and worked under Justin Siegel, who was a graduate student there at the time. And he would go to work in the Baker lab and talk about iGEM. And he told Justin, you got to come to some of these iGEM meetings. This is really cool stuff. So at the end of that 2008 year, Justin started coming to some meetings. And then at the end of iGEM, he said, you know, if you want help running this, I will co-run this with you. Mm. And that pretty much changed the trajectory of my life, because I changed my mind and said, I love this program. I just don't have the time to do all of it myself. So if I have kind of a co-conspirator to run this with me, I'll definitely do it. And the two of us ran iGEM at the UW for several years, years. And throughout the years, we had a number of really great projects. Our strategy was one of planting many flowers and seeing what grows. Mm. So one year, we had some students who had friends with celiac disease, and they wanted to build a therapeutic for the disease. And because we were working in David's group, we thought about, how can we use protein design to tackle celiac disease?
Yeah, I remember very distinctly the first time I went to an iGEM meeting. I think I had maybe only met Ingrid once or twice before that, but there were many very enthusiastic students there, and Ingrid was pitching ideas to them, and really seemed like just a fantastic person to put the team together. I think iGEM is a great project/organization. It gives undergraduate students the chance to work together on a scientific project, and they're well crafted, so they take about the length of time that students have. So I think it's wonderful, but it really depends on having, really wonderful, dedicated mentors like Ingrid for the whole thing to work.
So celiac disease, maybe a lot of our listeners know about that, or maybe some are less familiar. Just walk me through quickly, what, as a molecular biologist, what's celiac disease?
Yeah. So celiac is characterized by an inappropriate immune response to dietary gluten. So gluten is a protein that's found in any food containing wheat, rye, or barley. So it's ubiquitous in the food chain.
You think about it in bread all the time.
In bread, but in all sorts of other things that you might not necessarily think about. I mean, there's obviously the staples, bread, pasta, cereal, the pizza, beer, the typical.
They all happen to be delicious.
Yes, but also soy sauce is a source of gluten. Hidden gluten can be present in all kinds of different foods, especially processed foods. And it's a big issue because people with celiac disease can be highly sensitive to even small amounts of gluten. Mm-hmm. So the problem with the quote problem with gluten is that it's not very easy to digest. And so when you eat gluten, your body kind of incompletely digests gluten. And those gluten fragments then go through the stomach and into the intestines, only partially digested. And in most normal, healthy people, this is no problem.
You're not sensitive to it.
Yeah, they just go through your system. Hmm. But people with celiac disease mount an inflammatory immune response against these incompletely digested gluten fragments in the intestines.
So like an allergic reaction, kind of.
Like an allergic reaction, but it's not an allergic reaction. Hmm. And this causes all of the problems associated with celiac disease. So people with celiac disease have trouble going out to eat. The only treatment for celiac is complete elimination of gluten from the diet, which is very difficult to achieve, even when you make your own food.
There's no medicine for it. It's just you have to not eat the stuff.
That's right.
Yeah.
And given, living in today's society, it's unrealistic to expect that people will be able to strictly adhere to this diet. Mm.
You mentioned you had an iGym team where I think you said one of the students had a friend who had celiac disease. And that motivated a project.
That motivated a project. So we thought about, how can we use the tools of protein design and apply them for celiac? So it had been known in the field for some time that a great way to treat celiac disease would be enzyme therapy, where you give people an enzyme that can break down gluten in the stomach before it can get to the intestines and trigger the disease.
I was very excited that the students had picked celiacs as a target, and I was enthusiastic about their idea of designing enzymes to break down gluten. And it was exciting when they started getting hits. The activity looked really good, but I never dreamed it would go anywhere near as far as it did.
So just for our listeners who maybe don't live in protein land, what is an enzyme? Remind us.
Yeah. So an enzyme is a protein that performs a chemical reaction. So it catalyzes a reaction. And in our case, our specific enzyme is a protease. So it's a protease is an enzyme that breaks down proteins.
So a protein that basically destroys or breaks down other protein.
Yep. That's a protease. So enzymes have an active site that is like the business end of the protein that performs the reaction, and then that's scaffolded by other parts of the enzyme that may bind to things to activate them or may attach to cofactors that assist in the reaction. The enzymes really perform all the reactions.
They do the chemistry of life.
That's
they're,
right.
They're incredible. Mm-hmm. And I think as we're saying too, in normal just healthy digestion, a large amount of that at the molecular level, is done by enzymes.
Yes, done by enzymes, done by proteases, other enzymes that digest food.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, awesome. Okay, so I can start to see the makings of a project here.
Yes. So so oral enzyme therapy was known as, we did not invent that idea. But the problem was that that the requirements for an enzyme that would be really effective in celiac disease, it's difficult to find all of those characteristics in a naturally occurring protein. So the enzyme has to work in the conditions of the human stomach, which is really harsh environments. And it needs to break down gluten fast enough. Because, I mentioned that even small amounts of gluten can trigger the reaction. And this happens immediately upon entering the intestines. Mm. And also, the enzyme should be specific for gluten. Mm. Because we eat a lot of other proteins during a meal. We eat a lot of dairy protein, meat protein. And this other protein could affect the activity of the enzyme if it wasn't highly specific for gluten.
Oral enzyme therapy, that basically means like a pill or something you swallow, something you eat, that adds that enzyme to your stomach. So you need, we're talking about a really precise tool here.
Yes, it is targeted and focused.
Yeah.
That's right. So, the last thing is that it needed to be easy to manufacture. Mm. Because remember, the treatment for celiac is diet-based. And you needed to have something that, if it's too expensive, people are just going to try to manage it with their diet.
So this is something that academic scientists maybe don't spend a lot of time thinking about the manufacturability of some molecule. But I think in your experience, that can be just as important as any other property of that molecule, right?
Oh, yeah, for sure. In every project I've worked on, the ability to make the thing has been a huge part of the project. And even, I can talk about this more later, but at PVP, the company that spun out based on this, most of our budget was manufacturing. Hmm. We were not thinking about that at the time that we started this project, but it came out of necessity. So the ability to manufacture this enzyme easily, even at small scale, was born out of the necessity to be able to produce protein so that undergraduates could make this protein very easily and work on it over the course of the summer without having to push the manufacturing to even get small, microgram levels to work in the lab. So we had to have something that was easy, that was easily producible in E. coli. So that was a project requirement, but it ended up being, you know, having a large positive effect later on. Mm-hmm. We was picking mm-hmm. something that was readily manufacturable in E. coli. Yeah, so all of those aspects really lended itself to protein design, because people had tried to use naturally occurring enzymes, but they didn't work well in the human stomach. So instead, we started with an enzyme that worked very well in the conditions of the human stomach, and then engineered that enzyme to specifically target the inflammatory regions of gluten for degradation. So over the summer, the students used Foldit. So Foldit is a video game-like interface for Rosetta. And using Foldit, students made theoretical mutations in and around the active sites that were predicted to improve interactions with the gluten substrates. So we produced in the lab about 100 of their favorite designs and tested them for their ability to break down gluten. And those mutations that showed, you know, even small amounts of improvement in activity were combined and then put into another more rounds of design. So this was an iterative process that ended up yielding our lead molecule, which we called Cumamax. This was 2011. And the name Cumamax comes from the fact that the enzyme is called cumamilysin AS. It's from an organism that grows in acidic soils in Japan. So, you know, acidic, like the human stomach. And this was the variant that gave the maximum amount of activity, so Cumamax. So we did, you know, we got an enzyme that worked in acidic conditions that had degradative activity on a representative fragment of gluten. So we filed IP on these sort of early Cumamax leads. So that was very exciting after, you know, 3 months of undergraduate work, student work in the lab. We went to the iGEM competition in the fall that year and won. So the UW team won that year out of, I think it was over 165 teams from all over the world. It was actually the first year that a U.S. team had won the award. So it was very exciting. And we brought home the coveted BioBrick from iGEM.
So this is an incredible story. So let's go to those the early work that led up to the formation of this iGEM project. So you were working with these students in the lab, and you had found this really promising enzyme from nature, from Japan.
So yeah, so what the students did was they went through the Maripps protease database and found an enzyme that that works in the conditions that we were targeting, that had proteolytic activity on a peptide, so a short part of protein, that had an amino acid sequence that was not identical, but similar to what we were trying to break down. So it wasn't a stretch to think that it could be engineered to target what we did want it to break down.
I see. So you found sort of maybe a nearest neighbor out in nature, something that was a really promising starting point.
Yeah, and it had a low level of activity on our target. So the goal of that project was to increase it, to really get significant activity on the target.
Gotcha. And one of the other key details here has to do with acidity. Mm-hmm. This enzyme, before you did anything to it, was already, it worked in an acidic environment.
Yeah, so the enzyme is a serine protease, which is a common common class of enzymes, and but it's the amino acids that perform the reaction. One of those amino acids is a little bit it's different than the normal traditional three amino acids that perform this reaction that allow serine proteases to work at neutral pH. This amino acid swap changed the pH profile of the enzyme to be able to perform the reaction at a lower pH, and that is something that we did not change.
Do you remember what those experiments were like or what it was like seeing the performance of that molecule actually get better based on what the students had done?
It was really cool seeing the data come in, and you'd see, you know, baseline and all of these mutations that had negative effects on activity, and then some that did improve activity. Yeah, it was really exciting. We had no idea that it was going to turn into what it turned into. Again, this was all, you know, done by undergraduates. So the assay was a simple plate reader assay, and not a lot of work to set up, easy to run. This was a real basic kind of quick and dirty way to do it. But yeah, when the data started coming in, it was definitely eyebrow raising.
Wow. So then I got to hear the iGEM story this year in a little more detail.
At that time, they were testing using regional competitions first. And so we went to Indianapolis first. And I think that was in October. And that was extraordinarily exciting because we came in at the same level of all the other teams. And then we won a first place at that regional competition. They had three regional competitions. It was Asia, Europe, and the U.S. So there were three teams that were kind of, you know, people were looking at as
the winner's bracket.
Yeah. So when we went to MIT, you know, there were a lot of eyes on us. And the team that was from Europe was a team that had won previously, and they were kind of the favorite to win. Mm. And they had, we had practiced our presentation, but their presentation was just highly polished and really like a salesman pitch about their work. But we thought that we really had, you know, the nuts when it came to having the best actual project. Mm. And so when they announced the winners, we all ran up on stage, and Tom Knight, you know, handed over the BioBrick to the students that had done the most work in this project. And it was really fun. A culmination of many, many years of working on iGEM, which is a huge labor of love, because it takes a lot of work to train students and do it right. And at that point we came back from the competition very excited, did a few more experiments on this enzyme, published a paper, and then the students all went off to graduate school.
Right. But the project did not end there.
The project did not end there. So we generated this prototype, and that is commonly done in academia. Prototypes, things that can do a thing, are made all the time, but then turning that into something that is commercially viable is a massive undertaking.
So there's a word for this, a term of art that people use, translation. It's not a term I love, but it's this general idea of, you know, one way of doing science is maybe to have a research paper in mind as the goal. You want to do a great project, have your hypothesis and test it and show all your data and write it up and have it be peer-reviewed, and that's what science is. There's another way to look at research, which in a sense goes a lot further, which is, well, maybe that's not the end of the journey, but a stepping stone on the way to a different kind of impact. And that can look like making an actual product or making a company or making technology that ultimately somebody uses and benefits from. And the difference between the work needed to make an awesome scientific paper and the work needed to make a product or a technology or something that improves people's lives, there's a mountain of work.
Yeah, that is for sure true. You know, it's been said that we've cured cancer hundreds of times in mice, but translating it to humans is proven to be very difficult. The term, the highly technical term for that period in a project is called the Valley of Death. And it's because there are so many projects that just die for any number of reasons after the prototype stage. And being able to fund through the Valley of Death is, also, you know, frequently a stopping point. So our CumaMax, which we renamed CumaTen, was just a starting point for this project. This CumaTen was stable in gastric conditions, and it did break down one of the immunodominant fragments of gluten.
So check, check.
but it's there still had some shortcomings that needed to be addressed. Its activity was not high enough. We were targeting, you know, 99%+ degradation in the stomach before the gluten could get to the intestines. And it also didn't target all of the immunogenic regions of gluten. It only did the one that we had targeted when we picked one representative fragment. That's what it targeted.
I see. So it worked for one target, but there were more than one target.
There's actually multiple epitopes in gluten that trigger the disease. And we needed to have something, and it is tricky because you have to have something that's specific, but it also has to target different immunogenic epitopes. Luckily, all of the immunogenic epitopes have similar structural features that we could use to target. And then finally, you know, this enzyme is easy to make, but it had some constraints that would prevent its manufacturing at commercial scale. So we had to address that as well. So I happened to be graduating from graduate school at that time. And I sat down with David and with Justin, and we said that this technology is too promising to kind of just let it sit on the shelf ignored, which is what happens with a lot of these projects. So I took it up as my postdoctoral project in David's lab. And that was in, 2012. At that time, I also founded a company with Justin and David based on this technology called Proteus Biologics. And I received funding for my salary from what is now CoMotion and what used to be the Center for Commercialization, the university's tech transfer office. And I also got funding to hire a research scientist who worked with me. So, and those were both commercialization funding. So the intention of this project was to get through this valley of death. So we had support from CoMotion to do so.
I guess there were really two reasons we wanted to support translational work. The first was that we wanted our kind of basic research and design work here to have real world impact. And for that, it was really important to cross the valley of death to get the compounds to the point where they really could go out in the world and make a difference. The second reason is that with all this incredible talent, talented people here who, after finishing their PhDs or postdocs, wanted to really have their heart set into becoming a really leading the charge to deploy the things they've made in the real world and becoming an entrepreneur and learning how to do that. And with the translational program, we really tried to solve both problems by sort of funding the people who developed the exciting new compounds to develop them and to the point where they could start a company and really develop things for real-world applications. I think Ingrid is just a spectacular example of how well that can work.
Let me ask you this. So this idea of translating scientific projects is not new. People have done this for decades. But had it been done in the Baker Lab before in this way?
So we are not the first protein company to spin out of the Baker Group. There's RZeta. Alexander Zangalini was in the Baker Lab and spun RZeta out, but that was before the Institute for Protein Design was a thing. And we were also not the first IPD spin-out company. That was Cyrus. Cyrus spun out focused on increasing the accessibility of the Rosetta software. So they were predominantly a software company. So we were the first IPD company that spun out with a protein asset.
So this attempt around CumaMax or Cuma-10 enzyme coincided with the creation of the Institute for Protein Design and this idea that one of the things that this institute is all about is that translational work, not mm-hmm. just the basic discoveries, but then helping those discoveries mature to the point where they become a company, they become a product or a technology.
Yeah. So in kind of late 2012, I started my postdoc in David's lab, and he had just moved to the brand new molecular engineering building on campus. Very beautiful. I was very happy there. And Lance was hired by David's lab or the university or the institute or something to basically make the Institute of Protein Design a thing. And under his guidance, the institute really got up and running. they started this translational investigator program, which was meant for scientists who were working on a project that was intended to be commercialized, could apply for and become a translational investigator. And that allowed them to get their own grants and to be the, you know, PI of their own project, to hire people. And I was the first translational investigator. So I helped Lance put that program together. And a few days later, Neil King was signed on as the second translational investigator. And then the two of us, because of HHMI rules, the Institute wanted to physically separate their translational investigators from the rest of the group. So we went to J-Wing and set up that space for translational investigators, which involved, you know, spending some days just scrubbing decades of filth off of some of those shells.
What I hope the Translational Investigator Program would become is really a route for, you know, these amazing people here to learn how to start companies and to start successful companies and you know, really push protein design forward, the sort of the applications to real world problems. That's exactly what Ingrid did, and that her path has been followed by many since then. And the translational program has been growing ever since. And we just are starting three new translational projects, which are all very exciting. So it's grown considerably over, you know, from the beginning. And I'm really grateful to Ingrid, to both for help putting it together and help, you know, and for advising the next generation of entrepreneurs.
So Neil and I both started our labs next to each other in J-Wing, and mine stayed quite small. It was myself, my research scientist Clancy Wolf, and then at the most we had two other people in the lab, and Neil's lab just, you know, grew and grew and grew. And so we had help. Frank DeMaio had a computer cluster right down the hall, and I was kicked out of the lab because there wasn't space for me, so I asked him if I could have a desk in his room for a couple weeks, and then years later I was still there, but he's very nice. He never kicked me out. And so I had a ton of help from also, you know, outside the university. We relied heavily on Commotion to provide us with volunteer expertise. We had a great entrepreneur in residence, Craig Phillips. We had people working with us about manufacturing. We had people working with us about designing animal studies. We had clinical people that could give us advice on clinical studies. And a lot of the advice we ended up not necessarily following, but it was exposure to these different things that were going to be coming down the pipeline for this project at some point. We needed to start thinking about it now. So we had to go out and find that expertise. But luckily, the university had a pretty good network. I don't know if I mentioned the Institute for Translational Health Sciences. We use them quite a bit. The Washington Research Foundation provided mentors for that kind of thing. I actually got a Washington Research Foundation fellow, Will Canestaro, who ended up actually joining the WRF and doing really great things there before leaving to now he part-time works for an IPD startup company. But at the time, he was my WRF fellow, and he helped me to develop a net present value document with Lance that is basically a document that incorporates all kinds of different aspects of a project in order to help you calculate what your valuation is of your company today. So it's based on a ton of assumptions and calculations of risk. And
very, very much a part of the business world.
Yes. Something that I was not trained for as a graduate student. So then during this time, we accomplished a lot of things in the lab. We had this enzyme. It looked really promising. We needed to start testing it in kind of real-world scenarios for how it might be used. So we went to Dick's and bought hamburger, milkshake, brought it back to the lab, actually brought several for the lab. But specifically, we took a hamburger and a vanilla milkshake, blended it up, added the enzyme, you know, acidified to represent human stomach, added the enzyme, and as well as added some enzymes that were currently in clinical trials to treat celiac disease, but didn't work very well in conditions of the human stomach. And as a control, we use just the bun only and water, because the purpose of adding the milkshake and hamburger was to demonstrate, to see whether the enzyme can work in the presence of this other protein. And what we found was that it was a complete night and day response for these naturally occurring enzymes. Don't work very well in acid and are not specific for gluten. And so they broke down gluten to some level, but it was, you know, maybe 80%-ish, 90% for the bun, but only 50% if this other protein was present. But our enzyme was 99.9%, and in fact, it was degrading the enzyme, the hamburger and shake, down to below levels that the FDA would consider gluten-free in 30 minutes. And this was really, really exciting. We also tried it in beer. So we went out and bought Chainbreaker's White IPA, which is a wheat beer. So it has higher level of gluten than your, you know, standard barley-based. And we saw the same thing. And even at fridge temperature, within 15 minutes, it was what the FDA would consider gluten-free.
Yes, I remember very clearly. And that was the point where we all started believing that Cumamax could really be a drug, because it was just really night and day before and after a gluten digestion. It pretty much cleared the gluten completely from the sample. So yes, that was a very exciting moment, and it did absolutely bring home the potential real world impact of enzyme design.
I think it's just such a cool example of beginning to bridge that divide between what can feel like really abstract research that's happening in a lab where you're testing in a very controlled setting. You know, normally the way a scientist would do academic research is you'd buy some purified molecules and mix them in really precise laboratory conditions, and that's for rigor. That's because this is going to become published research, and you want to be really precise about all the molecules that you're using. But as a project like this, and this is just such a perfect example, as it tries to move closer and closer to a real product, a real technology, you start to bring in things like a hamburger bun. You start to really, okay, it's one thing to break down gluten in a abstract laboratory setting with purified molecules under perfect conditions. But what is it like when you put a hamburger bun and a bite of hamburger meat and a milkshake all together? Then how does the molecule perform? Because if it can't perform under those conditions, but maybe it only works in the ideal case, there's a problem with the technology. So you're moving closer to that real world bite of hamburger test.
Yeah, we were trying to make it as real world as we could.
What did that feel like to you? I'm curious, as you were trained in that one environment, and now you're putting hamburger buns in a blender. Did that feel different to you?
It was awesome. We had so much fun with those experiments. It was great because, you know, we're bringing in things from outside that, you know, we went to the restaurant. We bought the hamburger. We brought it to the lab. We added the enzyme. You know, we added a little acid and we mixed it up and we took samples. I mean, it's, I know it wasn't, but it felt at that point that we were actually bringing the enzyme into the world, because we were bringing the world into where the enzyme was. So the Translational Investigator Program supports its researchers through this time, but then in order to really bridge that valley of death, you need to bring in outside funding. We got $250,000 from the Life Science Discovery Fund, which unfortunately no longer exists. But that was a matching grant, so it was matched by an additional $250,000 with philanthropy, and that allowed us to do our animal studies. So for that, we used just normal rats and fed them a gluten slurry, essentially, and gave them the enzyme. And then half an hour later, the animals were sacrificed, and the amount of gluten was quantified in the stomach, and the gluten just disappeared in the stomach in 30 minutes. So that was really our pivotal experiment. We also used the funding to do something very important, which was to take the manufacturing out of the IPD. So at the time, the manufacturing core, which is an incredible asset at the IPD, was being developed, and it was being run by Lauren Carter And she helped develop a manufacturing process for fermentation, so producing the enzyme in a bioreactor. And we took it to a manufacturing facility. This one was at the University of Iowa, where they have tanks that are up to 1,000 liters. And the idea is that we would tech transfer and start being able to produce in a very standard way our enzyme in order to make the large quantities that are required to do the studies that are required to file an application to the FDA to go into people.
So this is maybe another way where this work is moving from maybe a traditional academic environment more towards the real world. You're beginning to use manufacturing tools, approaches that are a lot more like what you would see at a company. And here you're doing it to get the material you need to go through the testing you need to do. But it's...
Yeah, and the fact that we could do this while still at the university was a big deal to be able to show, to move this project out of the university. We were able to show potential investors that we had this process already running at a facility where they could manufacture enough that we could do these studies. So that is a huge question for anybody that's going to invest in this project, because, you know, there's only so much you can charge for products. So are you going to be able to produce it at a cost that justifies, you know, making a profit and selling it at this much?
Right. So in just making up numbers, it's, you know, maybe you do have an amazing enzyme and maybe it really does turn the hamburger or bun that you ate into basically a gluten-free bun after you eat it. But, oh, if that costs $1,000 a pill, then you're talking about a $1,000 hamburger meal. That's kind of a non-starter.
It would be a total non-starter.
Those business considerations start to become as important, maybe more important than some of the scientific considerations. You need to do all of them.
Yep, that's right. That's right. So, you know, having this animal study and having this manufacturing process as part of our data package was really valuable. So during this time, I presented as much as I could. This led to meeting an amazing mentor, Tachi Yamada, who was on the advisory board of the IPD in its early days. And, you know, I could do an entire podcast on him. He's an incredible individual. Unfortunately, he passed away a few years ago. Tachi used to run the Gates Foundation Research Division, and he was the CMO and CSO of GSK, GlaxoSmithKline, and Takeda. Everybody knew who he was. He really saw the promise of this technology and offered to come on board. He helped us sort of initiate preliminary meetings with venture capital. So at this time, he saw our animal data and said, you know, Ingrid, now's the time to leave. And I was like, no, more experiments. We can do this. We can look at this. We can do this. We can optimize for this. And he said, it's time to leave, which is, I think, also a difficult thing where, as an academic researcher, there's always more experiments. So knowing when something is good enough to move on, sometimes it takes that external kick in the pants to get going.
So when he said leave, what did he mean by that?
He meant spin it out of the university and into a company and go into people.
Wow.
So learned that there are a lot of things that make a project succeed or fail. Of course, the science doesn't work, but there's so much more. Is there an animal model that can tell you whether this will work or not? It's predictive. Can you protect the IP? Do you have freedom to operate? You know, is there other IP that might block you? Is it manufacturable? We talked about that. Is it at a commercially viable cost of goods? Is it toxic? Is there any limiting toxicity? Are there any administration or dosing constraints? Can you prove it in the clinic at any kind of reasonable cost? Do you have the right team to drive it forward? And then there's regulatory hurdles, and is there a market? And just, there's so much to consider about a project at this stage.
Each of those are what kills a project in that valley of death you were talking about. Each one of those could be fatal.
That's right. Yeah, exactly. So we had to really research every single one of those aspects in order to convince people that they should put money into this and to drive it forward. We were originally targeting venture capital, and conversations were going smoothly. And then at one point, I think this was 2015, those naturally occurring enzymes in clinical trials that I'd mentioned, their phase two data, in which they're using the enzymes to help people with celiac disease in a real world scenario, came out and it was negative. So those enzymes did not help people compared to placebo. Now, the asterisk there is that people on placebo improved. So, and there are a number of reasons for that I could go into that are hypotheses, but...
placebo is a strange thing.
But the placebo effect is real. The result from that was that you would think that that would be helpful because people would say, oh, you know, this is even more promising. It actually spooked people from the whole mechanism of using enzymes to treat celiac disease. So now VCs were no longer returning our calls. And Tachi said, well, we don't need them. We'll just go right to the drug companies. Those are the people that would buy this anyways. And so we went to what's called strategic, so strategic partner, and bypassed VCs entirely. So at this point, I also had to build a team to do this work. And I went through a lot of different potential CEOs, but it's hard to give your baby to someone. I'd been doing all the CEO work up until this point, but I knew that wasn't what I wanted to do. Mm. I wanted to be in charge of the scientific part of the program, and I didn't want to have to deal with all of the things that a CEO has to deal with day in, day out. So my goal was to hire a team with a CEO, a chief medical officer / chief development officer, program, manufacturing people, et cetera, and also have a lab. So putting that team together was hard. We had a VC tell us that a great team can make even a mediocre product succeed, but that a mediocre team can fail even a great product. So it was very clear that they invest in people. So getting the right people, and that's true at any level, I think. The most important asset you have is the people that work on the project. So we built our team. We got a great team. At our largest, we were 9 people at PVP. We had to change our name to PVP from Proteus because we got a cease and desist letter from a California company called Proteus Digital Health back when we had nothing and we were just a company in name only with $1,000 in our bank account. So we didn't have the means to fight it. So we just changed the name to something that was obscure and unlikely to infringe on anything. PVP harkens to Seattle's video game roots. So my husband is in the video game industry, and PVP stands for player versus player. And Cumamax, the enzyme, is a protein, and we're targeting gluten, which is a protein. So protein versus protein.
Protein versus protein.
And that was where the name PVP came from.
All right.
So PVP... started talking to Takeda Pharmaceuticals, and it took about a year from when we originally started talking to Takeda for the deal to get in place that would fund this work. So we entered into a partnership deal with Takeda.
For those who don't know, Takeda is a large pharmaceutical company based in Japan. Is that right?
Mm-hmm. But has offices in the U.S. And the deal was that Takeda would fund this work through phase one clinical trials. And then if they were happy with the results, then they had the option to purchase the company at a price that was, below what would be considered market price. Mm-hmm. And if they decided to not purchase a company, then the asset returned to PVP. So they had no ownership.
Okay.
So it was really a win-win situation because by cutting out the VC middleman, if they acquired us, then all of those proceeds went to the founders and to the university and to the IPD. And then if they didn't, then we just got $35 million of development money that was put into this project.
Wow. So they really took a bet on you.
They did, yes.
Wow.
So we had what I consider to be a difficult triangle of spin out, which is that we had to get the license in place from the university because the company's not going to put money into you unless you have the exclusive license to the technology. So we had the option to license the technology from the university. The company did. But if you have the license and you're still incubating at the university, that's considered a conflict of interest. So we needed the license to get funded. And we needed funding to spin out. But we had to be spun out in order to have the license. Mm. So it was mutually exclusive triangle. So all of those things had to happen at the same time. It was a very busy December of 2016, but they all happened within a few weeks of each other. And then we left the UW and we moved into an incubator space at the UW. We moved into Fluke Hall.
How big was the team at this point?
This was 9. So we had a development team of 5 employees in San Diego, and we had a lab of 4 people in Seattle.
Moving to this new location, it's in a place called Fluke Hall. What did that feel like?
Well, it was very exciting. I mean, we got to build up this lab from scratch. And we really did build it from scratch. The sink was cracked. We had to have someone come in and repair it. We had to have an electrician come in and install 240-volt outlets for our, you know, centrifuges and equipment. And it was building it from scratch, but it was to carry out this, you know, this our baby.
Was any part of it, were you nervous? Was it scary?
I was nervous because I didn't want to let people down.
Yeah, now there's, I think you mentioned, there's $35 million and more invested in this work.
Mm-hmm.
Multiple groups that exist to fund promising scientific projects have given you money because they see this technology, they see the data you're presenting, you and your team, and they think there's real potential here.
Mm-hmm.
I could imagine that creates a lot of pressure, a lot of weight on your shoulders.
Yeah, there was a lot of pressure, and it did come from that, but it's not just that, because we had, throughout our work, we had people with celiac disease writing us and saying, when is this going to be available? You know,
wow.
I'm suffering, my kid is suffering. We had people, there was a student in Boston who had a bake sale and sent us all of her proceeds because she had celiac disease, and she
wow.
thought this was promising, and some kid in Florida was sending us his allowance every other week. It was just, you know, it doesn't make a huge dent in the ability to buy supplies, but it's motivating. And, you know, I did not want this to fail because of some person-based mistake. If it's going to fail, it should fail because there's some issue with the technology that we couldn't predict.
Right, right. Science is what it is, but at this point, your job is to advance the best team.
Yeah, I didn't want to have a mistake of mine be the reason that this project failed.
Right, and I bet those bake sale allowances, like you said, it's probably not very important fuel for the company, but I imagine that's very important fuel for you.
Yeah, I'd say that's true.
Yeah.
Just reminds you that they're what you're doing this for.
Right. Wow. That's incredible.
Yeah. So so for the next several years then, there were 9 of us, but we worked with a couple of dozen consultants, some of which we talked to every day. So we had a massive consultant network. And we worked with a lot of CROs, contract research organizations, to get a lot of the work done, development work. We also did a lot in the lab, developing this single asset. We improved manufacturing. So we went from lab scale, milligram lab scale, to phase 1 scale, which was grams, to phase 2 scale, which was kilograms, although we actually did need to make a couple kilogram material to even do the studies that the FDA requires to go into people in the first place. So we had this production method. We pressed Cumamax into tablets, which was
wow.
really cool, made placebo tablets, which was fun. We ended up going into phase 1. And the phase 1 was safety and tolerability, which is what phase 1s cover. But we also included a proof of concept component wherein people ate like a smoothie that has gluten in it. And after about half an hour, all the contents of their stomach was sucked up through a nasogastric tube.
Oof.
And the content of gluten in that stomach content was measured. Mm-hmm. That was it. That was the study. It was similar to the animal study, but no one needed to be sacrificed.
Hmm. Can I ask a random question?
Mm-hmm.
What is a tablet of pressed, purified, gluten-degrading enzyme look like?
Well, in this case, it was fairly large tablets. Part of the development is, you know, how do you press a tablet? And so that's as small as possible with, you know, as large dose possible. So this is not much development had gone into at this point. So it's fairly large. It looked kind of like a light brown dietary supplement pill or something.
Mm-hmm.
But it's funny because this was in 2018 that we made these tablets. And in 2011 at iGEM, we had a someone's brought a, took a pill box, took the label out, and we made a label that said Cumamax.
Just a mock-up.
And we had fake Cumamax pills that were purple and yellow M&Ms. So
a little more interesting colors.
So it went from that kind of funny concept to actual tablets containing this enzyme.
Doing the thing.
Mm-hmm.
Do you remember when you first saw those tablets?
Yes, I did. I do. That was a really cool experience, yeah.
I imagine that. That strikes me as one of those milestone moments where, at this point, you've put years into this project. Like mm-hmm. you said, this is your baby. You're building this work. I imagine you're thinking about it night and day. And then comes the point, you know, there's many of these milestones, but that's a pill that
yep.
a person's going to take.
That a person's going to take. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's right.
Incredible. So...
So the phase one, so we did this experiment. We tested, and we had a few different arms in the phase one that looked at different conditions of how we would use the enzyme. And just like what we saw in the rats, we observed the same thing in humans. We saw a huge amount of gluten degradation in those phase one studies in every instance that we tested. Clancy used to say that the enzyme does not like to fail. So we saw that the enzyme doing very well in all of these different arms, except people are a little noisier than animals. And there was like this one data point that in which people had been given, you know, the enzyme and the enzyme didn't work. And the amount of gluten that we pulled out was the same as placebo. We were blinded through this process. And as the data was coming in, we were blinded as to whether the samples we were looking at had the enzyme or didn't. But, and by the way, the phase one was done with entirely liquid. The tablets were pressed in preparation for phase two. So this was just using liquid enzyme. But it was so obvious as we were seeing the data come in that which samples had the enzyme and which didn't.
Some of them have gluten and some of them don't.
The fact that we were blinded did not matter.
Yeah.
But
wow.
we had this one sample where they got the enzyme and they had the same amount of gluten as the placebo. And that one just drove me nuts. Everyone else was like, this data is amazing. It's amazingly clean. Look at this. And I'm pointing at this one thing. What happened
what
here?
This?
Because, you know, as a scientist, you're like, this should all be the same. And in the lab, your lab conditions are so controlled that it is all the same, but humans are noisier. So I've always wondered, you know, what happened? Yeah. So we published that data in the Journal of Gastroenterology. And then on February 25th, 2020, PVP was acquired by Takeda. So they did like what they see and they acquired, which was incredible timing because it was a couple of weeks before everything shut down. All my kids' schools shut down for COVID.
Yeah.
So you asked me earlier, like, what I would do differently, what kind of lessons I learned. Our preliminary license negotiations were really expensive. So when we negotiated the license to option the technology, you have to do that through a law firm, or it's strongly recommended it's done through a law firm. You are a university employee, so it's considered to be, you know, conflict of interest to negotiate, quote, with yourself. Mm. So this is done through a law firm. And our initial law firm didn't defer costs. And as a postdoc, with the postdoc salary, it was, you know, it's not the easiest thing to pay legal fees.
Mm.
So instead, we moved to a law firm that did defer costs, which is good because we racked up a huge legal bill in negotiating the agreement with Takeda and the license before we spun out. So they deferred their costs until we were funded and then they got paid.
I see.
We initially founded PVP as an LLC, which we didn't think mattered, but in fact, it does matter for tax reasons. So if you can set it up as a C Corp from the start, it's got a pretty big tax implication. We could have been a little more discriminating with our very early cap table. We took on a couple of people at a higher percentage than we probably should have. And it becomes an issue later on when you're trying to hire people and you're just scrounging for, you know, a quarter or half a percent of a company to give to somebody. So that's, I think, something to keep in mind for early stage companies. The choice of CEO is critical. We are in deep discussions with another person we ended up not going with who would have taken the company in a very different direction. And then in retrospect, we might have taken a little bit of money in seed money because some of the members of our team had to work at risk for longer than they were financially comfortable with. So it might have been a good idea to take some seed money, but everything ended up okay. So then once Takeda was acquired, I kind of transitioned from being full-time CSO of PVP. Once PVP was acquired by Takeda, I went from being full-time CSO at PVP to, because of COVID, to full-time homeschooling mom to my three little kids, one of which was a baby. One was in preschool and the other was in kindergarten. And, equal amounts of work, very different. Mm. Really good bonding experience. But, that was an interesting stage in my life.
Mm-hmm. I think I've heard you say that it's important that your girls see you doing what you love.
I think that is important. That's one of the reasons why I do what I do. I do what I do because I love the subject matter and because I want my girls to know how important it is to grow up and have a job and do something that you enjoy doing. So if they can see me doing that, then maybe they'll consider that as a legitimate life path for themselves. Not necessarily being a scientist. I would be shocked, pleasantly surprised if any one of them went into what I'm in, but I'm just in general.
Building their own way. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Maybe we could do this, an overview of working as an advisor.
Yeah. So after PVP, I went back to the university, the institute, and said, I've done this before. Is there other projects that I could help translate? When I was a postdoc at the institute, there was a graduate student, first-year graduate student, Stephanie Berger, who was working on de novo, completely designed on the computer, mini binder to treat IBD, so an IL-23 receptor binder. And she wanted, help founding a company spinning out based on that technology. So I helped her do that. And that company was called Mopac Biologics. And I worked there for about 5 years, helping her to translate the technology. That is it's a different experience than PVP. Also very challenging, very fun. We got a lot of really awesome in vivo data during this time we're running on seed money. And recently I started a new endeavor working with a project that was developed actually in Justin's lab. He's now at UC Davis. Justin is the director of the Innovation Institute for Food and Health there, and his lab is developing technology which is precision enzymatic decaffeination.
Mm.
So very different project. Again, works with students. This is very early stage, exciting for very different reasons. Also deals with the food component of the FDA, not the drugs.
So this is a coffee.
This would be a coffee product, yep.
Is it also enzyme-based?
It is enzyme-based, yep.
So whereas before the focus was an enzyme that's taking out the components of gluten, this would be enzymes that help get rid of caffeine.
Mm-hmm.
Wow. And then you mentioned this work with Stephanie. I think in both cases, they are instances where you are returning, in this case, to the IPD or to Justin, you're a co-founder there, and offering your perspective, which I think is really unique. There are not many people who have done what you've done in this field of protein design or really anywhere. And to do that well and to do that successfully is exceedingly rare. And so I'm curious, when you think about the early stage of advising on that work, if you're talking to scientists who maybe have that spark in their eye and they think that this is something they want to embark on, what do you look for? Or maybe what advice do you give? Seeing what you've seen and how complicated it can be, how expensive it can be, what do you look for in those earliest stages?
Well, I think you have to have an attitude where you're not going to get discouraged when things aren't going super great. I think a lot of scientists have that experience already. And I think that you have to recognize that starting up a company is... especially when you're in the leadership role, it is all consuming. So you can do other things in your life. I had kids during that time. But it's essential to have support, personal support. My husband, Scott, he's really supportive. And also, you know, there's only a certain number of hours in the day. So you have to be able to organize and plan. And it's a lot of work.
I'm curious, from your vantage point as a mentor in all these different contexts, what's it like seeing people that you mentor go off and build things of their own?
It's so awesome. It's one of my favorite parts. Our very first year, I mentioned we got runner-up best presentation at iGEM. The student that actually did the presentation, who was one of our iGEM students, Alec Nielsen, he ended up going to MIT and founding a company, Asimov, with Chris Voigt. And we had another student, Chris Iben, who founded a company called GigaCrop. The two students that did probably most of the work on the celiac project, there were a number of students that worked on it. Sydney Gordon founded a company called, I think it's called 48 Bio. She's now at Zara. And Liz Shepherd, who was Liz Stanley at the time, founded a company called Novome. It's a microbiology-based company. And then there's Jeff, who, you know, went into CSE here on campus. Rashmi was one of our iGEM students, and she now runs the protein production core at the IPD. So just the talent and working with these students and on their projects, and then I feel like working at iGEM really inspired them to get into the idea that they can build something that that could be something that is life changing. And I mean, it's got to be like there's so many of them have gone on to like develop these types of things. It's really been a cool experience. I love working with students.
That's awesome. So we're recording this episode. We're both part of the Institute for Protein Design here at the University of Washington. And you've really seen this place change a lot in your time here. Even in my time, it's grown considerably into quite a machine. And one of the things that the machine really is built for is launching companies, is this translational work. Could you share your experience of the earliest days of the IPD, where you were really a pioneer of those translational projects, compared to what it's like today at an institute like this that has more of that capacity to do translation?
Yeah. So at the time, you know, I mentioned the institute was just getting off of its feet. Everything was being developed. Everything was new. Sort of guidance documents, when you can say, around the translational advisor program was being developed. The institute was just getting off its feet at that point. But the cool thing was that there was just this buzz where everybody knew that what we were working on was something that was transformational, and not that, you know, we were all working on something that was for one indication, like it could be deeply transformative for this one thing, or that we're working on something that could have a minor effect, but on lots of different things. The knowledge that we were working on something that could have a major impact on many different fields was tangible. And the people involved, I made a lot of connections. I made a lot of friends during that time that have been lifelong friends. And it's been like at the Nobel Prize ceremony in December, meeting up with everyone from that time and seeing people that just went on to do incredible things and such diverse things has been just hugely gratifying. You know, Neil King, I've heard him say that the IPD is a family, and I think that's really true. And I think that's true at any place where you're developing, where you're working together to do something that's groundbreaking in science. You just develop these bonds that last. Where I was when I found out that David won the Nobel Prize, I was at UC Davis for a conference, and I was actually staying with Justin and his family and in their guest room. And that morning, I woke up to my phone blowing up, and I came out of my room in my pajamas, and I ran into Justin in the hallway, also his pajamas. Were like, did you hear the news?
Can you believe it? Wow.
And considering that it was, you know, that we were started working together years before because of David's work, it was a really fun way to find out.
Wow. That's really cool. Well, I think it's been a really cool experience chatting with you. I think we could talk for a couple more hours, but I want to thank you for the time, for sharing your story, and thanks for coming on the show.
Yeah, thank you. This has been a lot of fun.
My consciousness has a first-person ontology, but your consciousness has a third-person ontology to me.
Thanks for listening to the Baker Lab podcast. Your host this episode was Ian Hayden. This episode was recorded at the Institute for Protein Design at the University of Washington School of Medicine. It was produced by Nora McNamara Bordwick, Rikti Biswas, Ian Hayden, and Roni Weissman, with help from Anisha Segal, Nathan Greenwood, and me, Joe Min. Music is by Kevin MacLeod, as well as by The Wild Types, the band that Ingrid and her classmate Aaron Goldman formed during graduate school. If you liked this show, please leave a rating and maybe share this episode with someone else who might enjoy it. We'll see you next time.
First-person ontology, but your consciousness